This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The first time new Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos tried to visit a school her first week on the job, she was blocked by protesters. It was an unsettling debut for one of the most controversial cabinet appointments ever, from nomination to confirmation.
There's no need to pull any punches. For me personally, this confirmation process and the drama it engendered has been a bit of a bear.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from Secretary DeVos as she addressed members of the Department of Education her first day on the job. We'll also hear how companies who specialize in big data are making money off your medical records, and spend an academic minute getting thirsty at bedtime. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge.
I'm Phil Rosenfeld, now the acting general counsel for the department.
Phil Rosenfeld has spent decades in public service, and much of it in the U.S. Department of Education. For a couple of weeks this year, he was the acting Secretary of Education.
Actually, 2 weeks, 3 days, five, but who's counting?
Rosenfeld was speaking at a gathering at the Department of Education headquarters in Washington, D.C., to introduce the new education secretary. Here are some of his remarks.
Listening is at the heart of a smooth transition. Listening to the views and recommendations of staff who have years of experience and people who are new to the government as well. The mix of experience, new ideas, and innovation is at the heart of education. Our work is not easy, but it's necessary. Some days it's hard and challenging, but we stay true to our mission and we succeed. And as we continue to fulfill our mission, there may be changes in how we get to where we want to go for students. There may even be mistakes and bumps along the road, and we will be nimble to identify those and correct them and always do our best work. From the lens of an acting secretary, which I have had the privilege to do for the last 2 weeks, and we won't mention hours and minutes, I now know better than ever that our success is tied to the hard work of each and every one of the people that work at the department.
After speaking for close to 10 minutes, Rosenfeld introduced the new secretary.
So we are one team, and it gives me great pleasure and privilege to introduce the new secretary who will lead our team very, very well, Secretary DeVos. Thank you.
The nomination of Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary was controversial from the start, and her confirmation hearing was, to say the least, contentious. In the end, Vice President Mike Pence had to cast the tie-breaking vote in the Senate to seal her confirmation, something that had never happened before for a cabinet appointment in U.S. history.
I'm guessing you already know, but my name is Betsy, and I'm here with you, alongside you, to serve our nation's students.
DeVos thanked members of the department who were gathered to hear her remarks, singling out Phil Rosenfeld.
You all know Phil. You just heard from him. I've quickly learned he's a well-respected and familiar face around here. And as he mentioned, his service predates the Department of Education. While Phil and I met just a short time ago, I know he has done an outstanding job as acting secretary.
DeVos then spoke about her vision for the future of the Department of Education in a speech that was, as you would expect, short on specifics. Here are her remarks, some of which we had to edit, not for content, but because she had a bad microphone that kept cutting out.
Americans have tremendous respect for all those within and outside of these walls who work to make more opportunity available through better education. So let's turn now to recent headlines. There's no need to pull any punches. For me personally, this confirmation process and the drama it engendered has been a bit of a bear. Yeah. In all seriousness, for many, the events of the last few weeks have likely raised more questions and spawned more confusion than they have brought light and clarity. So for starters, please know I'm a door-open type of person here to serve with you. I'm committed to working with everyone and anyone from every corner of the country, from every walk of life, from every background, and with those who supported my nomination and those who did not, to protect, strengthen, and create new world-class education opportunities for America's students. Let's acknowledge, we've just come through one of the most bruising, divisive elections in modern times. And that's okay. The rhetoric and the words can get hot and heated, and the animosity often seems unending. And that's okay, too. People are passionate and moved by deeply held views. We are a pluralistic culture, and we must celebrate our differences. But all of us here can help bring unity by personally committing to being more open to and patient toward views different than our own. A key to our nation's unity and future is resident in the DNA of the Department of Education. It is in who we serve, the rising generation. Every child in America is born with innate curiosity. There is no greater achievement in the world than positively changing the life of a child by bending the arc or breaking the cycle through education. This is what motivates me. This is why education as a lifelong pursuit is my passion. And I know this is a passion we share. From students who may be struggling to hardworking teachers who feel stifled, special needs students and families to whom we owe our full support, and leaders and administrators seeking clarity and evidence-based solutions, the department has a complex population to champion. Even though I'm a grandmother, since this is my first day, I know I'm the newbie and I have a lot to learn. I pledge to listen and learn from you and from stakeholders around our country. I hope to earn your trust and confidence as we work together. I firmly believe we can genuinely unite around a commitment to the rising generation. And let's make this deal. I will challenge all on how and why we've done things a certain way. But I will listen to each of you on your ideas for how we can do better for students. You are professionals whom I respect. In building strong teams, embracing diversity and inclusion are key elements for success. Diversity may be viewed as cliche, but I believe that getting to know, working with, befriending, and including people who are different from ourselves is enriching and expanding. And if we model it ourselves, how much easier will it be to encourage students to do the same? In addition to modeling inclusion and a love of lifelong learning, the department also has a unique role in protecting students. We believe students deserve learning environments that foster innovation and curiosity and are also free from harm. I'm committed to working with you to make this the case. The obstacles between our nation's students and their pursuit of excellence can all be overcome. They're human problems. All too often, adult issues can complicate and get in the way of a focus upon those we serve. The good news is we can all work together to find solutions and make them happen. I'm reminded of the ancient counsel to act justly, to love kindness, and to proceed with humility. No matter your outlook, I'm betting we can all agree that acting justly, being compassionate, and moving forward humbly on behalf of the future of our nation, America's students, is a good place to start. So I ask every educator, every parent, everyone involved in educating our nation's students, and all of us here, let us set aside any preconceived notions, and let's recognize that while we may have disagreements, we can and must come together, find common ground, and put the needs of students first. And when we do disagree, let's set an example by being sincere and honest, passionate but civil, while never losing sight of our shared mission. To everyone on this team, my challenge to you is simple. Think big, be bold, and act to serve students. And I will promise you this. Together, we will find new ways in which we can positively transform education. It's day one for me, but it's simply the next day in this department's history to pursue its mission. I'm ready to work with you. Let's get started. Thank you.
Betsy DeVos is the new U.S. Secretary of Education. I'm sure this is not the last time we'll hear from or about her. Still to come, big data means big money, even if the people providing the data don't know it. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Big data is big business, and most of us are part of that business, whether we know it or not. In essentially every transaction we take part in, data are gathered and transmitted to companies. They use that information to make predictions about our future actions and our interests and other things that enhance their business and operations, and they do it without telling us. That includes when we go to the doctor. In a new book called Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records, Dr. Adam Tanner reveals how middlemen make huge profits connecting pharmacies, doctors, hospitals, and insurance companies to our medical information. Dr. Tanner wrote an opinion piece on the topic in the February 2017 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Dr. Adam Tanner is writer in residence at Harvard University's Institute for Quantitative Social Science and the 2016-17 C.W. Snedden Chair in Journalism at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I spoke to Dr. Tanner about how big data is using your information.
Patient data across the spectrum of healthcare is being sold, and that means you go to the doctor, the door is closed. You tell the doctor your medical issues. The doctor writes it down in an electronic medical health record system. The doctor sends perhaps a copy of a prescription to the pharmacy. Those transactions are recorded by these secondary companies, by the pharmacy and others, and that information may be sold. The doctor may send you to get a blood or urine test. That information may be sold. The insurance companies that cover the costs of these various transactions, they may sell that information. Your name will be removed from those transactions. It will say, patient, this age, this gender, who lives in this part of town, and who goes to this specific named doctor. All of that is a multi-billion dollar commercial trade.
And who is doing the buying and selling?
So the selling comes from the middlemen who handle the data, the electronic health records companies, the insurance companies that process the claims, the labs, so that would be the big lab names such as LabCorp, Quest and others, pharmacies, CVS, Walgreens, other major pharmacies. Those are the suppliers of the data, as well as middlemen you've never heard of. The buyers are largely the pharmaceutical companies who want to better sell and market their drugs. But there's also people such as investors on Wall Street who are trying to get insights on which drugs are selling well. And as I say, this is not only in the United States, it's a big multi-billion dollar trade internationally.
Well, let's talk about how big it is. How big is this total business in patient data?
Well, the largest data mining company is called Quintiles IMS. They're a company worth nearly $20 billion. Now, the amount of money made by any particular entity will vary greatly. So for a lab, they may make single-digit millions. A pharmacy, a large pharmacy chain, may make tens of millions of dollars. And then worldwide, this all adds up to billions of dollars. Some other names of companies that may be familiar to people would be LexisNexis, the big database company that's known for their legal and other services. IBM Watson Health has files on hundreds of millions of patients. Some of the commercial insurance companies have also set up their own divisions that sell the data, and so those companies would be ones known to many people.
Do patients have a say in determining what happens with their medical information, and should they have a say?
So right now, patients don't have a say and indeed don't know about this trade in secondary data. The data, once anonymized, is not considered your data, so you don't have a say in what happens to it.
And do you think, in your opinion, that that should change?
I think there are growing risks of having data in wide commercial circulation, and I do think it should change. I think patients should have the ability to decide for themselves what happens with their information, whether or not it's anonymized. So imagine some of the things you do that are very private. You go to perhaps a religious figure and you may give confession or speak to them personally. That's a conversation you wouldn't share with others. The same if you visit a lawyer or an accountant. These are personal, intimate conversations. Now, it might be really interesting for social scientists and others to get their hands on information that's anonymized, but it would undermine the confidence in the system. And I think that's ultimately the problem with this big commercial sale, is that when patients understand that their information is for sale at every point of the healthcare system, their confidence in revealing all of their issues to healthcare providers will be undermined.
Even though this data is anonymized, are there still dangers to privacy with medical information in commercial circulation?
So many years ago, before computing was very fast and when storage was very expensive, the risks were far less. Nowadays, though, as companies gather what is called longitudinal patient data, information about you going back years, it's easier and easier to get clues as to who is who. As I mentioned, there's some information about you already in anonymized files. It may include a year or date of birth, a gender, a full or partial zip code, and the name of your doctor. Now, if you put all of that information together over years, there are bigger clues. So, for example, I'm talking to you now from Fairbanks, Alaska, where I'm teaching at the university for a year. If you knew that I had medical care delivered here or gotten prescriptions or other things, as well as in my previous cities, I might be identifiable because before this, I lived in the Boston area in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and before that, I lived in Belgrade, Serbia. So I might be the only man of my age who meets that three-city pair that had medical help or visited a doctor in those various places. So it seems abstractly very hard that you could re-identify, but clues over time like that will allow outsiders to use the data.
So you figure a database like NexusLexis might be able to narrow you down?
Right. Now, again, the commercial purposes for which they use it is not about re-identifying patients, and they specifically say to their clients, you shouldn't re-identify it. But there are others who may try to take this information for purposes that are less commonplace than marketing and sales, which is the overwhelming use of the data. You could have adversaries that want to use the data. You could be discriminated against. It could be a high-level thing from the President of the United States down to a common person. But this information about you that's in circulation could be damaging if others could get their hands on it.
Well, finally, looking ahead, do you see any sort of protest going on against this sort of thing, or is this just going to continue?
Well, the reason why I've written this book called Our Bodies, Our Data, which just came out, is I would like to encourage a public discussion and debate about the issue. And in that discussion, think about what's the best way to handle our medical data in the future. What's happened now, we have a system in which commercial companies have decided for themselves what's best for the market and for patients and everyone else. This trade is legal. It's allowed under the HIPAA rules, but it's one in which the people receiving healthcare, and indeed many doctors, many nurses, and others working in the system do not know about. So my thought is it's hard to have an intelligent public discussion about what's the best system for us all. The vast swaths of the population do not know about this trade. So I think we should have a discussion as to whether or not to strengthen the privacy protections, to make patients in control of all of their data, whether or not it is anonymized. At the same time, I think that there should be a discussion of how to encourage science and research to use this data. But I think patients should be given the choice. The same way, if you want to contribute to charity, you have that choice as to when and to whom you want to give your money. I think there should be that choice when it comes to your medical data. There's many fine medical researchers, universities, and various institutions who are trying to solve disease and trying to come up with cures. Many people would volunteer and happily participate in getting their information to them. But I think they should have the choice. And right now, we don't have the choice, and we don't even have the discussion of what's going on because the trade in patient data is so opaque.
Is this trade used to develop new drugs, new cures, or is it just a marketing thing?
The companies such as Quintiles, IMS, Symphony Health, and others who are the big data miners, they say that this trade will help science and will help lead to major medical breakthroughs in curing disease and coming up with new cures. So far, however, when you ask these companies and officials involved in these businesses, they cite interesting analysis, interesting cost benefits, and so on, but no major breakthroughs. Still, the standard of scientific research remains double-blinded tests of two different groups of patients taking different medications, studying specifically in laboratory conditions. So although it's not impossible that we will have breakthroughs from the big data from patients, what's happened so far is it's used overwhelmingly for sales and marketing.
Again, the name of Dr. Adam Tanner's book is Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Are Making Billions Selling Our Medical Records. His opinion piece appears in the February 2017 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Do you get thirsty just before you go to bed? Ever wonder why? We did, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do you have a drink of water before bed? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Charles Bork, professor of neurosurgery at McGill University, details why you might want to be hydrated before zonking out at night.
A requirement for life to evolve on this planet was a need to anticipate the impact of Earth's 24-hour light cycle. In single cells, so-called clock genes evolved early on to optimize metabolism during the absence and presence of heat and light. Multicellular organisms later evolved master clocks that can orchestrate several different rhythms to adapt behavior and optimize organ function according to the time of day. In vertebrates, this master clock is located in a small region of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. This structure is located near the site at which the optic nerves enter the brain, and it receives light information captured by the eye to synchronize its timing. Although much is known about the anatomy and timekeeping ability of this clock, little is known about how it mediates circadian rhythms. Recent work by PhD student Claire Gazowski with the help of Christian Zelzer and myself revealed that mice increase water intake before sleep and that preventing this increase causes them to be dehydrated at wake time. Therefore, this behavior protects the body by anticipating a need for water reserves during the sleep period. Because we knew that thirst-promoting neurons are located in a brain region termed the OVLT, we investigated the mechanism by which the clock communicates with this area to promote thirst before sleep. Claire discovered that clock neurons and thirst neurons both increase their electrical activity before sleep. Moreover, she found that clock neurons extend long processes known as axons toward the thirst neurons. Using a technique that uses laser light to control neuronal activity, she showed that clock neurons induce water intake by releasing a specific neurotransmitter called vasopressin from the axons that contact the thirst neurons. Understanding how the master clock regulates circadian rhythms such as this one will eventually improve our ability to treat disorders related to clock malfunction and to better cope with shift work or jet lag.
That was Charles Bork of McGill University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.